and welcome to another episode in the Center Studio podcast series. I'm your host, Glenn Nelson. The music you've just heard is Balinese gamelan, and we'll be talking all about gamelan today. Where it comes from, how the sounds are made, what its history is, and how an ensemble called Gamelan Bintang Wayu became resident at Brigham Young University, and how the school came to bring international gamelan artists to campus in 2019. Our tour guide through this discussion is the wonderful and wise Jeremy Grimshaw. Alo dan selamat datang, Jeremy.
Wow, you prepared.
What language was that? I have no idea. Yeah, that was from Google Translate.
That was some passable Bahasa Indonesia.
I think it was supposed to say welcome.
Yes. Yeah.
Jeremy Grimshaw is Associate Dean in the College of Fine Arts and Communications at Brigham Young University. He received a PhD in musicology from the Eastman School of Music. He's published books and articles about music on a fascinating variety of topics, and he currently coordinates world music activities and events at BYU's School of Music in addition to directing Gamelan Bintang Wayu. I'm leaving out that he's also a percussionist, heirloom gardener, home renovation DIYer, father of four percussionist boys, art collector, curious chef, and resident of Payson, Utah. Does that more or less cover it?
Pretty much.
It gets to be a big business card that we're talking about if we include all of those things. And we're here in Jeremy's home, and it's very gracious of you to have me here. 10 years ago, I first came in contact with gamelan, something I knew next to nothing about. Let's paint a picture for those listeners who are equally new to it. Gamelan isn't a single instrument, but rather an ensemble of percussive instruments from Java and Bali. Is that getting close?
Yep. Yeah, that's...
How do you describe it when people ask you what it is?
The word gamelan is used sort of like the word orchestra would be, or band. So it's a percussion orchestra. Usually it's made of bronze xylophones and gongs and some drums and some bamboo flutes and a few other things. And there are forms of gamelan all throughout Southeast Asia. It's most closely associated with the traditions on the island of Java and next door in Bali. And our gamelan is Balinese gamelan. The main body of instruments in a typical gamelan ensemble are these bronze xylophones that sort of look like a xylophone or a vibraphone or a glockenspiel that you might see in a band or orchestra. But they're played in a different way. They're usually played with one hand with a hammer, and you play a melody, you play the notes with your right hand, and then you kind of unplay them one beat later with your left hand. You pinch the bar to...
It's like a damper?
Yeah, to kill the sound.
The music itself, does it come from a ceremonial place? Is it concert music? What is its origin?
There are forms of gamelan. I mean, there are records of gamelan in Bali anyway, going back about 1,000 years. And by records, I just mean...
Not long playing records?
Yeah, no, not records. 78s. Yeah. There's like a monument that has an inscription on it. And it refers to a gamelan ensemble. And then we have repertoires of different types of gamelan that go back hundreds of years. But it's pervasive enough, especially in Balinese culture, that you can't really pin it down to like ceremonial use or religious use versus popular use, because it's used all over the place. There are types that are more closely associated with certain religious occasions or functions. But there are also types that are at home in a concert setting and even a competition setting. When I try to think of how gamelan fits into a broader sort of culture and societal structure, I live here in South Utah County, here in Payson and in Spanish Fork and this part of the state, everybody plays softball. And when softball season is... And I don't even know when softball season is, but when...
Everybody but you, apparently.
Everybody but me, right. But people who are into it, they'll like play on their work team and play on a city team and play on their buddy's company's team. And in some ways, gamelan fills some of those social functions. It's very much a community thing, but it also fills artistic functions and religious functions. So it finds its way into lots of different aspects of Balinese culture.
So how many musicians... I mean, is it a fixed number, one of these ensembles?
It can vary pretty widely because there are lots of different types. There are types of gamelan that could involve as few as 2 or 4 players, and there are other types that could employ upwards of, you know, 50 players.
Huh. What about new music versus traditional music? So I assume that there's music that has been passed down in some way. Is there music that's being composed today for gamelan?
There's a really interesting relationship between the new and the old in Balinese music. And I'm talking mostly about Balinese music for a couple of reasons. In Bali, music plays a much more pervasive sort of everyday role than it does in other parts of Southeast Asia. So you can find gamelan in Java. It's an important part of Javanese culture, but it's less likely that somebody in this or that community would be directly involved.
Hmm. Do you mean it's not just background music, but they're actively creating music?
Right, yeah. If you go to Java, like as a tourist, you can go looking for gamelan and you can find it. In Bali, you would have a hard time sort of avoiding it. So, for example, a lot of tourists who go to Bali, they hire a driver to go visit some site. And they're driving along and the driver says, oh, we have to stop here because there's a procession. Maybe there's some temple ceremony going on or a funeral or something going on in a village or a town up the road. And, you know, if that's the only road between here and there, everything stops because the music and the ritual and the ceremony and the procession that has to happen in that village, it happens, right?
Is this music that's passed down? Is it notated in some way? Is it improvised?
Most music in Bali is not notated, at least not notated in the way that we might think in the West.
Black notes on a white piece of paper.
So sometimes, for archival reasons, a composer or musician might notate the basic melody of a piece. And you might notate that using a kind of like cipher notation. So numbers or characters referring to like scale degrees in a scale.
Almost like prompts in a way or something?
Yeah. Or like, you know, 1, 2, 3 or do, re, mi. Just giving indications of the basic contour of the melody. But that's not sheet music. You know, you can't really put that in front of somebody and say, okay, 1, 2, ready, go, and we play that. That kind of notation, when it's encountered, it really gives just a skeletal idea of the underlying melody of a piece.
Is it like jazz musicians with lead sheets?
A little bit, except in a lead sheet, you'd have like maybe a bass line and a melody and then chords. And I would say that if you encountered a Balinese musician using notation, it would be even more minimal than that, because it's for the most part it's an orally taught tradition.
And people writing new music today?
Yeah.
So it's a vibrant.
So place. Yeah, new music is part of the tradition, and that's one of the interesting things about Balinese musical culture and like pedagogical culture is there's not necessarily this same. Sometimes we. Like in the classical music world in the West, we perceive or imagine or maybe observe a kind of zero-sum game between, you know, high art and low art, or between classical and popular. That may exist to a certain extent in Bali, but I would say most of the musicians that I've worked with and studied with, a lot of the musicians that are doing new stuff are the same ones that are interested in old stuff.
I see.
And also some of the musicians that I work, especially younger musicians that I've worked with and studied with, a lot of them are really into popular music, including Western popular music. But it's not seen it's not seen as like, you know, taking away from the music that they do.
But there's not like a K-pop version of Bali's B-pop?
I should say there's lots of really cool popular music in Indonesia and in Bali. And some of that draws on traditional Balinese music in different ways. But there's not like this generational tension in the same way.
Yeah. I'd love to review how you came to gamelan. If I'm remembering correctly, you got into gamelan a little bit at Eastman, but it wasn't until you were teaching at Denison University in Ohio that you became a student. Is that right?
So I played in a group for fun. Actually, my wife played in the gamelan group at Eastman before I did. The group at Eastman included, you know, conservatory kids there at Eastman, but also faculty and students from other universities in the area and community members. So my wife played in the group for a while before I did, and then for a little while we both played it at the same time. And that community aspect was a really important part for Ellen Koskoff, who was at the time the president, actually, of the Society for Ethnomusicology and ethnomusicology faculty member at Eastman. And she organized the various activities, including enlisting the gamelan teacher, Neumann Swadin. So he was my first gamelan teacher there at Eastman. And I learned to play some of the instruments, and I learned some of the repertoire.
Because you were a percussionist?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of how it started. I sort of wanted to play a little more, because my academic program was mostly a nose-in-books kind of program. Mm-hmm. And as a sort of, by then, lapsed percussionist, I wanted to get my hands on some.
You had lost your calluses.
Yeah, that's right. I'd gotten soft. And I saw the instruments and I thought, it's just a bunch of bars. It's like playing the xylophone without any black notes. How hard could it be? Mm-hmm. And that was a dumb thing to think. And I didn't realize at the time that I was at the edge of a very deep and fabulous rabbit hole.
You went to Bali for the first time in 2008,
yep.
And in 2009 you gave an interview in which you briefly described Balinese culture. Here's what you said. It's a fascinating culture partly because there's just so much art crammed onto this tiny little island. When Islam spread southward and eastward across the Indonesian archipelago between the 13th and 16th centuries, the painters and woodcarvers and silversmiths and musicians and dancers that had been employed by the great Hindu courts of Java moved ahead of the wave of Islam and congregated on Bali. The whole island was a kind of big artist colony. As a result, the island's culture has a profound aesthetic inclination. As the saying goes, in Bali, we don't have art. We just do everything as beautifully as we can. What else were your initial impressions of the island and its culture? Had you read much about it before?
I'd read a lot because I was really interested in the music. And I studied gamelan for a few years before I was able to go to Bali. And at that time...
But just as an interest, it wasn't like your career, right? Or was it?
Not until I was at Denison. My first job out of grad school was at Denison University, and it's a wonderful small liberal arts college in central Ohio. And it's the kind of place where if you had a crazy idea that you thought would result in rich experiences for students, you could knock on the provost's door and say, can I try this
crazy
thing?
How about if we do?
Yeah. And part of this was spurred on by somebody alerting me to the fact that some instruments were for sale. And I thought, what if I just bought some instruments? And I was really clueless at the time as to like what I was getting myself into. I cringe a little bit at just, how ignorant I was, where I thought I could just start teaching this thing. I'm going to take some lessons. I'm going to buy these instruments.
There's a YouTube video tutorial.
Yeah, right. This is my masterclass. Right. So I was pretty clueless. I knew some repertoire from playing in the group at Eastman, and I loved this stuff, and I knew some teachers. And there had been a student at one of the TAs at Eastman, was a fantastic musician named Clay Greenberg. And I started studying with him as well. He's the one that alerted me to the instruments that were for sale. And I went to the provost and said, can I have some money to go buy these instruments and some more money to take some lessons to try to teach this to some students here at Denison? And they went for it, and they were very supportive of it. And so we started a small gamelan group at Denison, and I learned a few short, easy pieces from Clay and from Neumann Swadin, the teacher at Eastman. And so then we started this group kind of from scratch, and I was really sort of feeling my way.
At the same time, though, I assume you were teaching other classes.
You're
regular. Was it ethnomusicology, or was it, what was it that you were teaching?
So that position at Denison was music history and world music. It's a small faculty and a small department.
Were you the smartest one there?
Not even close, no. I can't think of very many situations where...
I don't think I've ever been the smartest one in the room, like including in the shower. Okay, since this first trip in 2008, you spent more time in Bali learning, studying, bringing students there, even performing. How has your connection to the culture changed since your first visit? I can imagine, just talking to you over the years as I have, you feel like it's I wouldn't say as far as like a second home, but you have a great degree of comfort there, wouldn't you say?
To a certain extent. My language skills are still terrible, like embarrassingly bad. And partly that's because I came to it a little bit late. A lot of people who study this stuff, that's what they did in grad school, and they wrote their dissertation on it. And I sort of veered off my expected path and fell into this because I loved it.
But I was surprised, even talking with you early on in this process, how you were really trying to understand the whole thing. It wasn't like a tourist going and taking pictures and saying, oh, I've been there, I know the culture. You really seemed to be immersing yourself in language and history and food and ornament and so on.
Every time I go to Bali, it becomes clearer how much stuff there is that I don't know. And how much more stuff there is to observe and soak in. When I first got into this, I knew I was retooling a little bit, mm-hmm. Career-wise and music-wise. And so I knew going in that I had to have the framework of a student. And if I was going to involve students, my students in this endeavor, that I had to make it clear to them that I was learning with them.
Yeah.
That I was a student of this music.
Well, I think that would be attractive to students to feel that way.
And I think that also kind of resonates with the way
it's a fit culturally.
Right. Yeah.
Is it common for people with your training who are teaching world music courses to also be making music, world music?
In some areas. It sort of depends on where the music that somebody's studying. Because sometimes somebody might be an expert or might develop an expertise on a musical tradition that doesn't really lend itself to like replication by an ensemble.
Right.
Sometimes the technique of a music, there might be sort of a threshold that it's not feasible to get to in a semester.
The barriers to entry are too high.
Right, yeah. And which isn't to say that that it's easy to learn Balinese music, but I guess Balinese music is a little more scalable to differing skill levels. We deliberately try to kind of foster the idea that it's a community ensemble.
Not just so the musicians can feel superior.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, and because
they're not
necessarily better.
Because they had to relearn. Yeah. They had to learn whole new practices too.
Yeah, the music majors don't necessarily have a leg up on somebody that just walks in.
So it's lessons in humility all around.
Yeah.
That's what you're
that's
saying.
Right. Yeah.
So let's listen to a little of this music. What are we going to hear? And why don't you give us like some idea of something that we can listen for in the music, because it might be completely new to us.
One of the challenges to somebody who's listening to Balinese music for the first time is that there's so much going on that it's really hard to get a sense of structure. One thing that I noticed early on as I observed how Balinese teachers taught this music is, there would be lots of stuff going on the surface of the music, really, really busy ornamental stuff. And then if you ask the teacher, so can you remind me how the tune goes for that section? He'd say, da, 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 da. I mean, sing something really simple. Mm. So I think one of the things, well, two things to listen for as you're trying to sort of penetrate the really busy surface of this music is that there are two actually really simple structural elements that everything kind of hangs on. There's a gong cycle. The largest gong, the lowest pitched gong, kind of governs the structure of a piece. Everybody in the ensemble, and if it's a dance piece, if it's a piece that accompanies dance, the dancers are listening for the placement of the gong. Everything's structured around the gong, mm-hmm. right?
When you say gong cycle, do you mean a pattern?
Pattern? In this excerpt that we'll listen to, we'll hear a few repetitions of a melodic section, and you'll hear the low gong. If you're listening on cheap earbuds or tiny laptop speakers, it might be hard to hear the gong. But yeah, if you're listening on bigger headphones or speakers, you'll hear the deep sound of the gong, and that marks repetitions of a section of a piece. So that's one element of the structure. The other element of the structure is that underneath all of the busy stuff, there's a pretty simple melody. And it's kind of like a bass line, but it's not limited to low instruments. That little melodic thread is kind of found throughout the ensemble. But then the surface, part of the reason that the surface sounds really busy is that different parts of the ensemble are taking that core melody and doing all sorts of pretty complex and very deliberate and specific, applying these formulas to ornament that melody. So the core melody might be what in Western music we might think of as a quarter note or a half note, moving along at a pretty moderate pace. But we might be hearing on the surface a level of ornamentation of that melody that's maybe 16th notes. Mm-hmm. So it's really busy, but all of these busy notes are kind of surrounding and weaving around this core melody.
All right, let's listen. What is the name of this piece?
So this is a piece called Puspanjali, and it's by a composer who we'll talk about later because he's our guest director of our ensemble this semester, Nyoman Winda.
Let's take a listen. When did BYU get into all of this? Does it predate your arrival?
Well, sort of. So I had been at Denison for 2 years, and around that time, BYU had decided to change parts of its curriculum related to music history and world music. They posted a job, and I initially hadn't thought I would apply, because it was specifically for somebody that had a PhD in ethnomusicology, and my PhD was in musicology, and I just sort of defected into ethnomusicology and gotten into gamelan. BYU had decided to expand its offerings related to non-Western classical music. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know that they were specifically looking for, you know, somebody that would come and teach gamelan, but they were looking for somebody that would come in and open up some new musical possibilities.
So then when you came to BYU and as the discussions evolved, you said, have you considered gamelan?
One of the questions when they invited me to interview and I came out to interview, and one of the questions was, you know, if we hired you for this job, would you want to start an ensemble? And if so, what would it take? And at that point, I said, I'd love to start a gamelan. I started a gamelan at Denison. But already at that point, I knew, you know, that it wasn't just a matter of ordering instruments.
Pull these instruments out of the dusty caverns of BYU, because they don't exist.
Right, yeah. And also, I knew that there would be a steep learning curve for me. Well, I was already sort of climbing that curve at Denison. And so I don't know if I made this wish explicit when I interviewed, but at that, even that early on, I thought I would love to be able to start something at BYU, but eventually I would love to get things established and get enough support for it that somehow I could bring in a Balinese teacher to give the students the experience of learning from a really experienced Balinese teacher.
Well, I mean, it to mimic your trajectory of going to Bali and learning instruments firsthand, so on.
Right.
So, okay, so congratulations, you get a job, you come here. It's not like there are any instruments to play, so how do you commission instruments to be made? Because, again, there's no Amazon website to order an ensemble just for, is that, or maybe there is. I haven't spent a lot of time surfing.
Back then there wasn't. Now you could actually go online and buy some instruments. So we found the funding to buy some instruments. So we actually enlisted one of my teachers at the time. He's a fantastic musician named Gede Asnawa. And Mr. Asnawa sort of acted as the broker and our go-between to help us select an instrument builder and work out the logistics of commissioning and shipping and all of that stuff.
Well, I think if someone has never seen this and can't quite picture what they look like, they're like sculptures that make music. In 2010, you wrote a gorgeous book called The Island of Bali is Littered with Prayers, about your experience going to Bali, this commission of instruments. And I loved how in the book you described these two distinct cultures of Bali and Provo and how they gradually came together for you in a number of ways, metaphorically and then literally with the arrival of these instruments. And one of the chapters is titled Stowaway Spirits in the Shadow of Mount Tipinogos. And I thought I would ask you to read an excerpt about it. So this is, and you have no choice to say, but to say, yes, I will do it. Well, why don't you set up the scene of this?
So we had ordered the instruments, and they took several months to build. And
ship, I assume. It came by boat?
Yeah.
Because there's an ocean right here on the side of Provo. I don't know what the last leg of this trip was.
So it took quite some time because they're very heavy. And so these are the instruments that they just arrived from the shop of Wayan Brata. And he died just a few years after he built our instruments, or his shop built our instruments. And he was one of the famous instrument builders and composers and musicians in Bali. And I'd been thinking a lot about what it meant to try to do this thing, to try to take these things that meant so much to me out of the place that they were from and try to make something out of them.
Is it hubris? Is it like, am I biting too much off? Is this not going to work?
I had already realized that, yes, absolutely, I had bitten too much off.
Nevertheless. Yeah.
But I was in too deep, you know?
The instruments are coming. Okay, so
they'd already cashed the check. You know, the instruments were here. And so I've been thinking a lot about, well, how do I try to make sense of this thing, that this music that embodies this idea, or at least this ideal, I shouldn't say the idea, but embodies this ideal of community and interaction. And one thing I didn't mention before is that the key to all of this music is that you have to listen to each other and play together in a way that requires a lot more like micro coordination than most musicians are used to.
Because is it a conductorless experience?
The drummer is kind of the conductor, mm-hmm. but the part that's really tricky, the part that's I think the most challenging for even really skilled Western musicians to figure out how to make their body do or to make their hands do, is that all of these different parts that are ornamental, they're usually split between multiple players. So, like, you don't really play the melody. You play half of the melody, and the guy next to you plays the other half.
Oh, I see.
And you have to line it up like teeth in a zipper, right? Uh-huh. So this guy's notes fit in the gaps between your notes.
Uh-huh. Is it kind of like piano four hands?
Piano four hands, if you're playing a scale and you played the C, but then the guy next to you has to play the D before you play the E.
Got it. That's the zippering.
Yeah, that's the zippering.
That's the official Balinese term for it.
Right. Well, so the Balinese term is kotekan. In gamelan, that happens really, really fast. Right? And that's the community part that really appealed to me. And I wanted to figure out a way to sort of, I don't know, align or make that rhyme with this Zion notion, right? This idea that part of our devotional life is supposed to be, you know, imagining what community should mean, right? What it means to cooperate with people and get along with people.
How confident were you that people would embrace it? Because it's one thing to technically do it. The other thing is that would people be interested in doing it?
Yeah, I had no idea. I was very I was very worried that we were going to unpack all of these crates and then, you know, what happens if nobody shows up, or what happens if everybody's like, oh, that's way too loud. So yeah, there was a little bit of worry there. But as I was writing this part of the book, I was trying to think of some sort of poetic way to make sense of this juxtaposition. And so the reason I called in the shadow of Mount Tipinogos is that in Balinese culture, there's this tall peak in the middle of the island, not in the middle of the island, but it's sort of the spiritual center of the island. And so much on the island is like physically and spiritually and even geographically oriented towards this beautiful, tall mountain, Gunung Agung, which it turns out is within a couple hundred feet of the elevation of the top of Mount Tipitapas.
Right? About that?
So...
will we ever get to listen to this excerpt? This
mysterious. Would you like me to read?
That we're queuing.
I've got an excerpt here that I could read for you. Okay.
That was like 20 minutes ago.
I know. I'm sorry. When the instruments arrived, I couldn't help but notice that the unpacking party was a kind of music of its own. A polyphonic chorus of hammering, the groan of boards being forced out of square, nails squealing at the pull of crowbars. The 21 crates, some of them as big as refrigerators, and all of them sturdy enough to protect their heavy, precious cargo on the 9,000-mile, 3-month-long journey from Bali, Indonesia, to Provo, Utah, put up quite a fight before giving up their contents. Luckily, a large welcoming committee had already assembled for the job. Some percussionists who had learned about these new exotic instruments, an Indonesian biochemistry major looking for a reminder of home, a few students, some with prior musical experience and some with none, who had simply fallen in love with recordings of Balinese music and were eager to try it out. One of the reasons I had ordered these instruments was because I had experienced their curious ability to create a sense of cohesion and community simply through the sounds they made. As it turned out, they had already begun their work even before they were out of their boxes. Although the builders had emailed some pictures from Bali, we were still taken aback by the instrument's beauty. The giant gongs hung suspended between intricate gilded scepters. The double-headed drums were sheathed in bold swatches of hand-painted fabric. The jackfruit wood frames of the graduated bronze xylophones were covered in elaborate carvings with figures and filigree busily jostling for space. The front panels of several of the instruments depicted scenes from the Ramayana, the Hindu epic recounting Prince Rama's rescue of his wife Sita from Ravana, the evil ten-headed demon king of Lanka. One packing crate fell away to reveal a golden deer fleeing from Rama's arrows into the forest. More hammering and pulling, and suddenly a benevolent gold-winged vulture appeared to protect the princess. Someone tore through layers of bubble wrap, and there was Hanuman, the animal god, arriving at Sita's room to deliver Rama's ring as a sign of her imminent rescue. The back panels depicted various stories from the Panchatantra, ancient Sanskrit animal fables created to prepare the children of nobility for their future responsibilities. Lined up in a row and viewed from the back, the instruments, bustling with monkeys, jackals, crabs, cranes, and snails, looked like the cars in a miniature circus train. Each scene was carved in relief and painted in gold against a deep blue background. Blossoms, cornices, and rounded crenels in gold and bright red surrounded these tableaus. Fierce butukala, demons meant to scare away evil forces, protruded from the instrument's sides. The two largest instruments bore our group's name on their front panels, Bintang Wahyu. My good friend Ed Luna, a polymath expert in the languages, dance traditions, and musical styles of Indonesia, had suggested the name to me. It ingeniously followed two Balinese traditions, while at the same time reflecting the unique spiritual aspirations of the instrument's new home at Brigham Young University, the flagship school of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or Mormons. First, the name Bintang Wahyu invoked divine blessing through vivid imagery. Bintang means star, especially a star of good omen. Wahyu means vision or revelation. In fact, Wahyu is the word for the Book of Revelation in the Indonesian translation of the New Testament. Considered together, the words evoked a sacred cosmology, star of vision. Second, the name formed a clever play on words by containing within itself a reference to its new home, Bintang Wahyu, BYU. Opposite the panels bearing the ensemble's name, facing towards the players and away from the audience, another figure had been carved into the instrument casings. This one was entirely unique among all Balinese instruments anywhere in the world. It had occurred to me as we were placing the order with the builder that in order to create a community around this ensemble, it would help to have something unusual, something of our very own, to connect us with the instruments. We would need, right from the start, some lore. It seemed appropriate and resonant with the cross-cultural nature of the instrument's acquisition to conceal some small symbol of Mormonism somewhere among the Hindu and Balinese figures, just as the instruments themselves represented a small island of Hindu Bali culture within the Mormon Sea of Provo. These two panels bore our curious logo, a stylized Balinese version of the iconic sunstone. This emblem had adorned the temple in Nauvoo, Illinois, which the Mormons had barely erected before being driven out by mobs in 1846. The Balinese carver replicated this unique Mormon symbol closely, except in one important respect. The hands descending from the corners above the smiling sun no longer held trumpets as they had in Nauvoo. Trumpets, after all, are nowhere to be found in most Balinese ensembles. Instead, the angelic hands bore the mallets and hammers used in Balinese music. I relished the beautiful incongruity of it all. The drab basement rehearsal space filled with these glimmering instruments, the jumbled religious iconography, and this room full of students eagerly waiting to make music from the other side of the world. We cleared away the lumber and packing foam and arranged the instruments in order to take in the sight of them all at once. Together, this elaborate percussion orchestra, the first of its kind in Utah, constituted a single collective entity known as a gamelan.
You write way too well to be pushing spreadsheets the rest of your life. Just throwing that out there into the...
Thank you.
I remember you telling me that you didn't really have any plans to return to Utah to teach. You're originally from Washington, Utah, right?
Yeah.
But that you felt compelled to accept the BYU offer and to start a Balinese gamelan there as you reflected on a passage from Doctrine and Covenants. Do you remember this story?
No, I don't.
Yeah, so, well, I'm glad you're here. Here's what you wrote. Nearly hidden among this section, referring to Doctrine and Covenants, section 130, nearly hidden among this section's bold, sweeping exegesis.
Okay, I remember now. Sorry, go ahead.
Sweeping exegesis on the nature of God and the cosmos, however, there is one tiny and seemingly soft-spoken phrase that reveals what I think is one of the simplest and most profound divine secrets. That same sociality which exists among us here, it reads, will exist among us there. In other words, heaven, on its most fundamental level, is simply an eternal aggregation of those familiar human relationships that make mortal life meaningful. The most profound joys that we experience on earth among family and friends and community are the same joys that make heaven heaven. So that's quite an epiphany for you.
It was quite an epiphany.
Yeah. Any further thoughts on that? I mean, that's almost prophetic. Has that come to pass for you?
Well, I think reflecting on that, when I see really, really good Balinese musicians, especially when they're playing interlocking parts, you know, those parts, the teeth of the zipper. A couple of months ago, I saw our current guest director, Niaman Winda, performing on stage with another of my teachers, Dewa Bharata. So these are just two just legendary musicians and composers in Bali. And I saw the two of them performing together, and on one piece they were playing the two drums. And the drum parts are really complicated. A lot of musicians that are really good at gamelan never learn the drum or never like play it publicly because it's really hard. And watching those two guys play drums together, I was watching that going, I can't think of very many situations where people get to do something that that is that complicated and that fun. There's a kind of joy that comes from being able to like master time and do something that hard and complicated and pull it off. I just think that's there aren't very many kinds of joy in community that are more pure than that kind of interaction.
Yeah. I mean, as you say, the same joys that make heaven, heaven.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
What does Latter-day Saint theology and culture have to do with Gamelan? Are there any? That's just too wacky of a question.
Well,
isn't it?
No, I don't know that it's too wacky. I mean, but it's like my answer to that question would be like, you know,
nothing and everything.
Everybody sees you know, through their own lens, and so, you know, my answer is going to be, well, it's exactly congruent. You know, I mean,
yeah, right. Because you've made those connections,
right? Yeah. And I think it's important. I think that's the end when students come and play in the group. You know, that's the story that we try to tell. Is this culture can teach you something about the relationship between music and community, and the joy that can come from this kind of music and this kind of community.
Well, that's, it's baked into your university that students would be looking for things like that in any kind of educational experience.
Right. But I think the next step of that is, you know, we a few years ago, we started a study abroad program. And so we've taken several students. We've done three trips now where we've taken students to Bali. And while I think that general idea, that sentiment holds, it becomes more nuanced and problematized to a certain extent, because, you know, Bali, like anywhere else, is a complicated place. And so you can tell this beautiful story about, here's this beautiful music and this beautiful idea of community, and here's what it sounds like, and here's what it feels like when you can play that music and try to feel that sense of community with the musicians around you. But, you know, then we take students to Bali and they get to experience that musical part and that community part on a different level, and they see it played out in a lot of different ways. But they also get to see that culture in a more complicated and more faceted way.
But it's not like it's this entirely pure culture either.
Right,
it's so overrun
yeah.
with tourism that, like, what is pure Ubud? I don't know exactly.
Right, yeah. And also because...
But you could say the same thing about any place practically.
Yeah. And you know, tourism has a huge impact. The dynamics between... Because part of Balinese culture is tourism. I mean...
Because it's performative?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, Balinese artists have been thinking about the relationship between globalism, or the relationship between tourism and what they do, for a long time.
Oh.
That, I mean, that thought process goes way back into Dutch colonialism in Indonesia. Part of the complexity of a student studying a Balinese music in Bali has to do with observing it, you know, and being one of the interlopers, right? Trying to experience the music on a complex level. But the other part of that is that they can also witness this music within communities that are also complicated, and they can get a richer sense that, you know, if it's true that Balinese music imagines this kind of community, it's an aspirational imagining.
Hmm.
You know what I mean?
Because, kind of. I mean, I'm not entirely, because I'm still seeing this from such an outsider's view, that I'm not entirely sure of how this all works. Like, would a Balinese person say that a group in America performing Balinese music is somehow distasteful or is appropriating in some way? Or
it would sort of depend on how it's done. I try to be careful about how I talk about the teachers that I've learned from. I try to make sure that I recognize the gatekeepers that we rely on to give us access to this to this music. And that kind of goes back to the idea that I try to present myself as a student, and we bring in a Balinese teacher and he's the teacher, you know. But the other part of that is that I tell this slightly romanticized story about interlocking parts in the music that weave together and create this sense of community. But I think it's sometimes easy for us to, like, read into that kind of beautiful poetic metaphor the idea that that must mean that, you know, Balinese communities don't have problems, or they don't have tensions, or they don't,
yeah.
you know. And so when a student can observe and participate in music in that more complex way, then I think it tells the story in a more real way.
Isn't that a metaphor for globalism itself?
I mean,
I think of Utah as being different culturally than where I live in New York City as far as demographics, but it's far from homogeneous here now. And so how do those themes play out with gamelan as another component of the multicultural society that Utah is becoming?
I think, and this is the way, this is kind of the soapbox that I stand on when I teach world music classes generally, not just when I'm teaching gamelan. The soapbox is that our experiences with other cultures, we should never come away from those experiences thinking that we've had some sort of comprehensive survey, right? That we get it. I think the most important lesson to come away from is like a kind of humility and awe at just how much stuff there is, how complex the world is, and how much more there is to explore and try to understand.
I'm curious about another thing that I'd like to kind of slightly change the subject on. So in creating a gamelan community, that's not just the players and not just the audience, but it's also composers. So how have local composers embraced the ensemble, and have you had composers who are writing music for gamelan?
Yeah, we've had a number of collaborations with composers. And I should say this isn't a hugely innovative thing, because
it's part of the tradition.
It's part of the tradition. Composing new music is part of is part of Balinese music. So, we've had collaborations with a number of composers. I think the first collaboration we did was with Christian Asplund.
And adventurous soul, doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, so he composed a pretty adventurous work, and it was very much a collaborative thing because he wanted to know what these instruments could do, right? And so
it was his way of exploring the sounds possible.
And so he'd come to us with an idea, and I'd say, well, if you break this up between this instrument and this instrument, then you can do this cool thing, you know. Uh-huh. So he composed a piece.
It would be more gamelan-ese,
right? It would draw on, you know, it would take advantage of some of the idiomatic potential.
I see.
Yeah, so Christian wrote a great piece for gamelan and amplified viola.
Okay.
Called Time and All Eternity. And since then, we've had a number of student composers write pieces for us. Curtis Smith, he played in our ensemble and then went off to grad school. And then he composed a piece for gamelan and carillon that was really fun and tricky. Nate Thatcher is one of our alums and a composer who wrote for us. I know I'm going to forget some people and I'll feel bad. Recently, we've had a couple of really fantastic compositions from student composers. Dallin Frank, who just graduated last year, composed a piece for us. And Stuart Wheeler, who is now at studying composition at Wesleyan. So he was in our group for quite some time and a fantastic composer and songwriter. And he composed a really adventurous and idiomatically informed piece, sort of inspired by Kafka short story called Odra Deck, who anxiously awaits death, I think is the subtitle.
Let's listen to a little bit of that.
Let's listen to a little bit of that. And
listen for?
I'm going to give you two little excerpts. And one of them uses some kind of extra instruments that come from the gamelan tradition called anklung. And these are tuned bamboo rattles. And so Stuart used these not in a pitch specific way. So you're going to hear these just thick, rattly sounds I had never heard anything like it when I first heard him use these masses of these bamboo rattles. We'll hear a little bit of that in the first excerpt. And then in the second excerpt, we'll hear some of where he's drawing on a little bit more of the idiomatic potential of like the interlocking parts of the gamelan. So we'll hear kind of an underlying melody in the lower instruments. And then on top of that, we'll hear a little bit of this kotekin, this interlocking part where the ornamentation is split between different halves of the ensemble.
To wrap up, listeners might be surprised to know that there are gamelan ensembles all over the place. Isn't that right? All over the country.
That's right. And all over the world. Yeah.
So how might they discover them or even join them?
Depending on where you are in the U.S., there are a few places where there's gamelan stuff going on. The oldest group, I think, in the U.S. is a group called Gamelan Sekarjaya. That's in the Bay Area. And they're actually celebrating their 40th anniversary this month with a series of concerts. There are some gamelan groups in the D.C. area and at a number of universities. If you're in a college town, there's a decent chance that there's somebody doing gamelan. It might be Javanese. And, you know.
Is your nose going up or down on this?
No. I don't. No. I'm just. It's
you're
different.
You're just saying.
I'm going to sound. Yeah.
Is there a Latter-day Saint church presence in Bali at all?
There's a branch in Bali. There's a small branch in Kuta, and there's a much more extensive presence in Java, the next island over. I don't know that there are any proselytizing missionaries. At least the last time I visited that branch, and I haven't been in a year, but there weren't any proselytizing missionaries in Bali. There might be now. But yeah, there's a little branch.
I'd be really interested to see how members of the church there might weave together elements of multiple cultures. That always fascinates me.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm very much intrigued by that, especially the arts that different cultures are making with a common religious belief.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see
how that... I should send you on a scouting mission to investigate.
Well, and it'll be interesting to see how that develops in Bali. I mean... There are all sorts of complexities to the idea of proselytizing in that part of the world and some specific complexities related, you know, to specifically to Bali. The Kuta branch is pretty interesting because there are some Indonesian members. Many of them are Javanese because in that part of Bali, there are quite a few people from that move from Java to work in, you know, the tourist industry in Bali.
What's the best experience you've had with gamelan so far?
The best experience I've had with gamelan so far. I think can I do two?
The best two.
The best two.
What are the best two experiences you've had in gamelan so far? Okay.
So one of them definitely is that this year we are honored to have this husband and wife power couple from Bali. Nyaman Winda recently retired from the faculty of the National Conservatory in Bali.
I just saw him. He looks like he's 25.
Yeah, I know. and he emanates just power. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's an incredible musician and composer. And so he's our guest director this year for the gamelan ensemble. And I have just loved learning from him and watching him teach and just watching him think musically and interact with students. He's just a brilliant, brilliant musician. His wife, Gusti Warsiki, she recently retired as a dance teacher, and she's teaching dance classes at BYU, and we're going to perform jointly later on this semester. And one of the things that's been really wonderful is to watch her teach dance. She's an incredible teacher and an amazing dancer. And watch how students react to her teaching. And also watching how he, as a musician, works with her as she's teaching dance students. So watching the collaborative process between a dance teacher and a music teacher, I'd never been able to witness that happening in real time. You know, I've seen performances of dancers that I love and musicians that I love, but watching this husband and wife team that are just such incredible artists working together, that's been really, really wonderful.
How long will they be residents here?
Two semesters. So they'll be here for the 2019-2020 school year. Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
All right. What's your second experience?
So the second experience is, it's really special. It's very sad, but it's also really, really meaningful for us. So one of our teachers is a wonderful musician named Made Lasmawan. And he's come and performed with us, and I've studied with him. And he's one of our hosts when we take students to Bali. And he teaches in the United States, but every summer he goes back to his home village, which is a little town called Banga. Later on in our study abroad, we go to bigger cities and we see bigger stuff. But we start there when we do our study abroad program because we basically live in his family compound with his extended family. And the music that we do is tied into whatever's going on in that area while we're there. And so we never quite know, like a few months out, we never quite know what kinds of musical experiences we're going to have there. Mm-hmm. In 2018, we're on our way to Bali with a group of students, and we're actually pulling away from the gate in Hong Kong. We just had our layover on our way to Bali. We're pulling away from the gate, and I hadn't turned my phone off yet. And one of my friends who is in Bali, there in Banga with Mr. Lasmawan, she calls me and she said, when do you guys get here? And I said, we're going to be there later tonight. And she said, Lasmawan's sister just passed away this morning. And she was a wonderful woman. She helped run the whole operation with the extended family and all these guests, and just a sweet, sweet person. And she had passed away suddenly and at far too young an age. So we were, those of us in my family who knew her, we were just, crushed by this news. But I also had to figure out what to do with these students. So I scrambled to get lodging for that night when we got to the island. And then I'm sitting there going, so what are we going to do? I don't know if we can go spend our 2 weeks in this, in Lasmawan's home. So trying to figure it out, we're kind of winging it. And the next morning he calls me and he said, so when are you guys coming up? And I said, are we? Are you? And he said, oh yeah. I said, I'm so sorry. And he said, yesterday was awful. Yesterday, they had to do all of the worst stuff that happens when a loved one passes away. He said, yesterday was awful, but now we've got all these ceremonies to do. When a Balinese person dies, there's a lot of ceremony. A funeral is not one day, in Bali. And I said, are you sure you can host us? And he said, oh, yeah. And he said, and we're going to put you to work. And so we go up to the village, and instead of learning whatever music we had or that he had all previously planned for us and whatever performances, we learned music to perform for some of the ceremonies for her funeral. And so the students were there right in the midst of it. So we performed at one of the funeral ceremonies, and then he taught us some music to play for a processional where they take her body from her home to the cemetery. And so he taught us the music to play for this processional, and then we show up, and that day it turns out it's pouring rain, and we're soaked, and I don't know how good we are. We're okay. But some of the students had never played any of this stuff before. So we play in this processional for this very special woman's, the initial part of her funeral. And afterwards, our teacher, he was just beaming. He was so happy with how it went. And I was like, he can't be that happy. Like, he can't be that happy.
This is not music criticism.
Right, yeah. That can't be pegged to how well we played. And I was talking to him afterwards, and this central element of Balinese culture is this idea of rame. The way you make something sacred is by making it busier. And in the West, we tend to think of the opposite often. You know, if there's something we want to make sacred, we like have a moment of silence or something like that. But something, if something's really important, you have to surround it with people and with noise and decorations and as much stuff as you can. And that's what makes it sacred. And so part of the reason that he was so happy about it was, you know, it's Bunga is a small village and everybody else had stuff to do to prepare for all of the funeral ceremonies and everything. And so just having a bunch of extra bodies that could play instruments as part of this procession made that event more special and more sacred. And so our students, whatever had been on the docket before, you know, everything changed. And for those 2 weeks, they had to learn music that was meant for a real experience. It wasn't an experience that was like created for us to have. And so it was a really sad time, but it was a really rich and beautiful time. And also a joyous time, because part of Balinese life is, you know, celebration.
The joy is what makes heaven heaven.
That's exactly right.
On behalf of the Center for Latter-day Saint Arts, I thank you, Jeremy, for your time today. What a wonderful thing you're doing. You can learn more about the Center for Latter-day Saint Arts on our website. In addition to this monthly podcast series, we publish a weekly art companion to the Come Follow Me curriculum with artists, commentary, and gospel questions. Previous events, including festivals, are available for viewing on our YouTube channel. And one of our latest initiatives is college and university courses on Latter-day Saint Arts, including a new course syllabus just posted by Jeremy Grimshaw. Hooray for you, called Music as Cultural Practice in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It's an excellent course.
Thank you very much.
I would take that. I would sign up. I would pay tuition for that course.
How much?
Not very much. It's a fantastic course, but that's not criticism. It's a fantastic course that anyone can read. Again, it's on our website, centerforlatterdaysaintarts.org. Thanks for listening, everybody. Goodbye.